This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
There's fire in the house. Fire because our customs, tradition and cultural heritage continue to be abused.
That's Andreas Lekunze Membo, a traditional village ruler in Cameroon and president of the Liaban Chiefs Conference, on a separate fighter staging a brutal campaign to enthrone himself as king. Also, there is no sign of tensions easing between Rwanda and Uganda. A gathering of women technology experts meet to promote women's involvement, and the climate action movement spreads to Nigeria. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's a lot more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, there is outrage in Cameroon after a separatist fighter who chased several traditional rulers from the English-speaking Lablem district enthroned himself as king. Raids by the military to capture him and ensuing battles led to the deaths of 11 suspected fighters and the beheading of a police officer. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé, where traditional rulers who have escaped met over the weekend.
This is the voice of Lekianka Oliver, a separatist fighter who proclaimed himself the ultimate ruler of the Lebelem district in the English-speaking southwest region. Heavily guarded by his fighters and accompanied by several women he says are his wives, Oliver, dressed in local traditional regalia, announces that he is the only king of Lebelem. Recently, Oliver's fighters attacked and chased away many local traditional rulers and notables. He said they supported the central government in the war to make the north and southwest regions independent from the rest of Cameroon and its French-speaking majority. At least two of the traditional rulers were killed. Andreas Lekunze Nembo, traditional ruler of Babumbu village and president of the Lebelem Chiefs Conference, says the escaped chiefs are outraged by the desecration of their palaces.
There's fire in the house. Fire because our customs, tradition and cultural heritage continue to be abused. The desecration of a palace by separatists. Secondly, general insecurity, intimidation, and these barbaric actions to our greatest surprise.
In an attempt to capture Oliver, the military says it mounted raids on separatist camps in Lebelem, killing at least six fighters within the past 3 days. Other battles were reported in the northwestern towns of Bamenda and Dop, killing another five separatist fighters. The fighters also beheaded a policeman. Colonel Sonny Joseph Ajang, Director of Administrative and Regulatory Affairs in Cameroon's Ministry of Defense, says the separatists have beheaded seven people over the past month.
We ask ourselves, why do you chop off the head of somebody they have already killed? This is to send some warning waves to the minds of soldiers, but we stay resolute as far as our duties are concerned, irrespective of all the atrocities we have.
Deben Chofo, governor of the English-speaking Northwest region, says security services are attempting to stop the barbarism.
It's unbearable. And on behalf of the government of the Republic, we condemn it strongly. And the investigation are ongoing to uncover those that have done that devilish act.
Early this month, Cameroon's President Paul Biya organized what he called a national dialogue to solve the separatist crisis that has killed close to 3,000 people since 2016. Separatist groups on social media called the dialogue a non-event and refused to participate. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
A month has passed since Rwandan and Ugandan officials vowed to ease tensions and set up a follow-up meeting. Instead, a number of incidents have made relations worse, and there is no sign of the new meeting. Eugene Wimana has more details from Kigali.
It was on 16th September in Kigali when Rwanda and Uganda, together with mediators from the Democratic Republic of Congo and Angola, had an ad hoc meeting. Ugandan officials were supposed to invite their Rwandan counterparts to Kampala. But the Rwandan government says it had no word from Uganda. State Minister in the Foreign Affairs Ministry, Olivier Nduhungirehe, calls the situation unfortunate because the two countries are essentially sisters.
Rwanda and Uganda, as Minister Kutesa said, share historical ties that should normally build a strong strategic alliance given the long-standing bonds linking the two peoples and countries.
Instead, Rwandan government says it registered numerous cases of insecurity incidents from Uganda. 45 assailants who attacked Rwanda's northern province and killed 14 civilians said they were recruited in Uganda. 25 soldiers said in court that they fought for the Rwandan National Congress, a dissident party operating in exile, or admitted to having military roots in Uganda. That runs contrary to what Sam Kutesa, Uganda's Foreign Affairs Minister, said when he was in Kigali last month.
The point is that we have nothing to benefit in destabilizing Rwanda. Just like I think we have nothing to benefit by destabilizing Uganda. We are going to be investigating all these allegations and counter-allegations, and we shall find a way of resolving them.
The follow-up meeting in Kampala was to be tasked with discussing the implementation and progress of the Luanda Memorandum of Understanding to put an end to Uganda-Rwanda tensions that have festered for a couple of years. The agreement was reached with the help of Angola's president, João Lourenço, and DRC's Félix Tshisekedi. The current situation makes political analysts sound pessimistic about the effective implementation of the Luanda agreement. This is Gatete Thierry.
But these MOUs are pieces of paper if people don't have the will to implement what is in those pieces of paper.
Ugandan government did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Though high-ranking Rwanda's soldiers trained and worked in Uganda's army before 1994, the fact that some who fall out with President Kagame and stand with Museveni put the implementation agreement on hold. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
In Mozambique, the ruling party appears to be heading for a larger-than-expected election victory that has led the main opposition to claim fraud and urge the voting to be annulled. Preliminary results with two-thirds of the ballots counted showed the Frelimo party with 75% to 20% for Renamo, a former rebel group that signed a peace accord with the government in August. Renamo president Osofo Momade called last week's voting the most fraudulent election ever seen in the country. The party was meeting today to plan strategy. While the elections were relatively quiet, the lead-up wasn't. 10 people were killed since the start of campaigning, and final results are expected within about a week. A gathering of African women technology experts has met to promote women's involvement in technology, including artificial intelligence. Africa is seen as a ripe market for artificial intelligence, and at Women in Tech Week, they want to make sure African women are at the forefront. Stacey Knott reports from Accra, Ghana.
When Lily Edenam-Boche was studying computer science at a university in Ghana, students were forced to write programming codes on a whiteboard because there were not enough computers. This made it difficult to apply the coding skills they were learning, she says, and the problem continues today.
We have students coming out of schools having their theoretical background, which is very important because you can actually appreciate something practically if you don't have the theory. But the industry-ready skills is lacking because they didn't have the hands-on experience.
Boche wants to see more resources in Ghana and across Africa for students to get practical experience in technology, especially for girls and women. Today, she is a system tester and works to mentor other young women in coding and artificial intelligence. Boche presented at the Women in Tech Week in Accra, along with her colleague, data scientist Aseda Adai Dese. They explained to participants what artificial intelligence is, how it works, and most importantly, how it can be used and developed by African women. AI can help a community overcome a lack of health professionals or increase agricultural yields with automated farming. For Adai Desse, the potential for AI in Africa is boundless.
Africa is the next market because there are so many problems here yet to be solved. And where you have so many problems, you have so many opportunities. So definitely Africa is the next big thing now.
Adai Desse says while more Africans were taking notice of AI, the majority of the industry is in North America, Europe and Asia and is largely male. She wants to see more investment into developers across the continent, especially in women. Real estate agent Maya Yerdom was watching the two women's presentation. While excited about AI's potential, she is also concerned about technology replacing jobs in Africa, where many nations already suffer high unemployment.
Work, as we know it, is going to change, and I'm not sure millions, possibly billions of us already. How are we going to survive?
The focus on artificial intelligence at the Women in Tech Week comes 6 months after US technology giant Google opened an AI lab in Ghana, the first in Africa. Developers at the lab will focus on creating products for education, health, and agriculture to solve problems in Africa. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
In Nigeria, men who have left the Islamic militant group Boko Haram are finding they face stigma and other issues as they return to civilian life. A program at a psychiatric hospital in Maiduguri treats the former insurgents. Chika Odua reports from Maiduguri.
56-year-old Ibrahim Dubji is still trying to adjust to life out of the bushes. It's been about 3 years since he left. He was a fighter with Boko Haram, taking cover in the arid terrain of rural northeastern Nigeria. He traveled with the group to invade villages and carry out attacks. He says he struggled with the group's extreme mode of operation. He says, "What I will never forget is when they killed my brother's son in my presence." He found a way to escape the group and went through Operation Safe Corridor. It's the Nigerian government's official rehabilitation and de-radicalization program. Dubji says he's now a reformed man, but he's treated like an outcast. He wasn't welcomed back to his hometown, so he's living in a refugee camp in Maiduguri. He says, "People will be suspecting you, that you are still Boko Haram or a Boko Haram informant. The government has already cleared us, but still, people around are suspecting us. I need forgiveness from people." Hundreds of people linked to Boko Haram are being released by the Nigerian military to rejoin civilian life, but they face intense social stigma and mental health problems. A group therapy session is underway at the Federal Psychiatric Hospital in Maiduguri. It's the only one of its kind in northeastern Nigeria. Here, psychiatrists treat former Boko Haram insurgents sent over by the military. Dr. Sadiq Pindar, the head of clinical services and drug rehabilitation, says substance abuse is a major problem with many former insurgents.
We know there are quite a number of them might be having some personality disorders or social phobia, and in which makes them to take drugs so that they can express themselves. And substance use is on the rise.
Forgiveness for reformed insurgents is a controversial issue, but security analyst Joseph Babatunde Satome says it's vital.
When they're really sorry, they are sorry. But they still, as I said, they still need close monitoring. You send them to jail is not even going to be the solution, because they can go and start planning from the jail too.
He thinks the government should allow reformed insurgents to work for private businesses. Analysts and peace negotiators say that many Boko Haram members are ready to come out, but they're afraid of being killed by neighborhood vigilante groups. The Civilian Joint Task Force or CJTF, set up in 2013, is the largest such group operating in Borno State, the heart of the insurgency. It's tasked with helping the Nigerian military's counterterrorism operations and has achieved great success in flushing Boko Haram members out of Maiduguri. One of their commanders, Baba Shehu Abdul Ghani, says that the CJTF will not harm insurgents who surrender, but says they won't win acceptance overnight.
CJTF are law-abiding citizens of the nation. If anybody tell you that CJTF are ready to kill those people or whatever, I think he just talk. There is no any source for that. Those people, they kill people, they slaughter people. Many things, many businesses has collapsed. Many people suffer in the community at the grassroots. So this thing is not easy.
It's also not easy for the ones who have renounced Boko Haram. Analysts fear that if they don't find acceptance in civilian life, then they'll go right back to the insurgents' life. Chika Odua for VOA News, Maiduguri, Nigeria.
The climate action movement, known as Fridays for Future, has spread to Nigeria, where it's being led by a 16-year-old schoolgirl, Faith Wins Iwor. The movement, started by a Swedish teenager, Greta Thunberg, has been joined by millions of school children worldwide, and they are demanding immediate action to counteract global warming. For VOA, Timothy Ebiozu has more from Abuja.
16-year-old Faith Wins Iwu, who is sometimes referred to as Nigeria's Greta Thunberg, wants Nigeria to contribute to the global fight against climate change. To achieve this, she has started planting trees around her school and neighborhood and recycles used plastic bags into shower caps. Iwu says she has been concerned about the effects of poor environmental practices for years.
I still having this guilt. Anytime I see someone throw something out the window or I see people dispose wrongly, I felt as if they were harming me. And when I began to think about it in a certain way, they were harming me because it's my future. If I do not take care of it now, I may not have a generation.
An estimated 4 million students worldwide have taken part in the Fridays for Future movement launched in August 2018 by Thunberg in Sweden. In recent months, hundreds of Nigerian school children joined the movement. 2 weeks ago, 300 students from 10 schools in Nigeria walked out of classes and carried out protests in Abuja. Fanny Nerlander is the Swedish ambassador to Nigeria.
I think it's fantastic to see the young generation taking responsibility and asking for climate actions to be taken, because it is their future and their future planet that is endangered. So it is incredible to and very inspiring to see that the young people of Nigeria are standing up and asking for actions to be taken.
However, Iwu is concerned that awareness of environmental threats in Nigeria remains low.
Not very many people know about this. Only a handful know about this problem. So I am lucky to be one of the few that know about this problem, and I am trying my best to sell the idea to the world that it needs to save it from ending.
Nigeria is the biggest importer of fossil fuel-powered generators in Africa, and therefore one of the biggest emitters of greenhouse gases. Environmental experts like David Michael say climate change has serious consequences in Nigeria.
Unfortunately, we in Africa contribute very little, to the cause of climate change, less than 3%. But we are the most vulnerable continent, and of course in Nigeria here, the effects are everywhere. The desertification up north, sea rise, down south, in the middle belt, the crisis between the farmers and herders.
At a summit last December, Nigeria was one of 195 countries and territories that agreed to take steps to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. In real-world politics, that pledge is more likely to be fulfilled if more school children like Iwu demand immediate action toward that goal. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News Abuja.
Rabbit meat is slowly growing part of Africa's diet, with the expanding industry in South Africa and Nigeria, and a group of hardcore rabbit farmers promoting the meat as cheap, healthy, and environmentally friendly. But will it take off? Critics say they are reluctant to eat animals that are considered pets. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Could rabbit be the new white meat for Africa? African farmers are looking for a new solution for the continent's growing appetite for meat. Africa's population is set to nearly double in the next three decades, to 2.5 billion people. The answer to those many, many new mouths to feed, they say, could lie with the humble bunny. In the past decade, South Africa's largest rabbit meat supplier has added nearly 150 rabbit farms to its stable. And breeders recently created a South African breed, the Pendula, which translates to the answer. Independent farmer Gavin Guguren keeps 500 rabbits at his farm outside Johannesburg. He says he thinks it's the meat of the future.
As National Council, we've been saying for the last 12 to 15 odd years that rabbit has the potential of being the savior of Africa from a protein point of view. The reasons behind that are a multitude.
For one, he says, rabbit meat is high in protein and low in fat and cholesterol. They take up little space and don't eat much. They require less water than chickens and put out less waste than cows. Rabbits, Gorin says, may be the greenest meat.
There's a lot of negatives that are currently happening around carbon impact on the planet, specifically around feedlotting of animals on a large scale. We talk about cattle and beef that are put into feedlots. So you've got huge carbon footprints there. Rabbit's carbon footprint is minimal compared to the rest.
And finally, he says, they breed like, well, you get the idea. But can they make the leap from pet to plate? Sloan Meat Market Manager Richard Letcher says he's noticed South Africans' appetite for meat is expanding to more unconventional options. His shop is one of the few in Johannesburg that stocks rabbit, but it's still moving quite slowly.
What has changed within our environment over the last year is that there's been a lot more of a request for goat meat, which we haven't sold before.
He reasons that rabbit, which is still slow-moving, could see the same growth. But has he taken the bite? He cited the single biggest reason people give for not eating rabbit.
I haven't got my mind around eating my pet at this point, so no.
His colleague, meat cutter Manalisi Smakade, says he's missing out. He loves rabbit meat, which brings us to the critical question.
It tastes like chicken, sort of chicken. It's not hard like the beef. Very nice and soft.
As Africa's population is set to nearly double by the year 2050, food supply, especially protein, is a major concern. Could the humble rabbit fill that gap? And millions of stomachs? Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington. For all latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned for the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. And on behalf of our producer Bill Wakinja and our engineer John Braden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news, and information.